Wild, a journey through time and Ireland's changing nature. We are about to go on a journey, a trip through time, beginning when Ireland was still covered in ice. We will look at the landscape through the eyes of the very first humans to arrive on this island, a land of reindeer, brown bear and wolves, roaming through thick primeval forests.
You want a little bit of imagination to imagine what Ireland was like then and the changes that have taken place in the meantime.
We will be exploring how wild nature changed as successive waves of colonists arrived, each moulding the landscape to their needs and values.
When the Cromwellians came in, it was a very different approach because they were coming from a landscape where wolves had been gone for several hundred years, and they saw them as a direct threat to the colonisation of Ireland, the creation of, as I would describe it, as the shiring of Ireland.
And today, there is an unprecedented disconnect with the natural world. There is no doubt that the path we are on is one of destruction, but perhaps we are on the cusp of a great change.
I think there is an incredibly exciting alternative that we could be living in that connects us with the natural world, and it's going to involve probably radical action in order to make that happen.
My name is Anya Murray. I'm an environmental scientist. When I was a child, I spent all my time roaming about the fields and lakeshores of West Wicklow, climbing trees and making huts and dens, picking primroses, and exploring every nook and cranny of the land about me. I was completely immersed in nature. When we moved to the city, I was devastated. The loss of freedom and nature, the confinement. And perhaps I've been trying to figure out that loss ever since. Over the course of this programme, I'm going to explore how wild nature has come to be what it is today. How different were the landscapes of the past to what we see around us? How do we begin to imagine what the future might hold for Ireland's landscapes? This is the story of Ireland's wild past, present and future. Every good story begins with an ending, and the story of today's landscape is no different. It begins with the end of the last ice age. For most of the last 2 million years, Ireland was covered in enormous ice sheets. That means that while Paleolithic people were creating exquisite cave art at Lascaux in France 17,000 years ago, Ireland was still a land of ice and snow. When the last of these ice sheets melted, the land bounced up in relief at the unburdening, and the island of Ireland as we know it today was born. To understand just how different Ireland was after the ice sheets melted, and how our ancient ancestors moulded their environment, I travelled to Connemara to meet with someone in the know.
Many, many years ago, I was out around the bogs of Connemara, and by accident, I came on this woodland.
This is Michael O'Connell, a paleoecologist who has spent a lifetime of scientific discovery, unlocking the secrets of our ancient landscapes.
It was just so lovely, because there were so little trees in Connemara, and they harp back to the early primeval woodlands in Ireland.
Standing underneath an old oak tree in these ancient woodlands with Michael, I tried to imagine our ancient primeval woodlands. Here we were surrounded with sprawling old oaks, their fissured limbs soaring up to the sky, draped in mosses and ferns, beams of sunlight pouring through the rich green layers. It's hard to imagine how none of this existed 13,000 years ago, when the post-glacial landscape here was an expanse of tundra, like Siberia is today. When the climate warmed and the ice sheets had eventually melted, about 11,000 years ago, the first trees began to arrive in Ireland.
The first real good shrubby plant that arrived was the juniper. And the juniper responds very fast. And Ireland, for probably, 100 years, 200 years, was covered with juniper. The next tree that arrives was the birch. As the tundra disappeared, this birch spread right up from the south, and there were extensive birch woodlands. It became the dominant species. The next species that arrived then is the hazel. And interesting, in Ireland today, we have still some of the most extensive hazel woodlands in Europe, really. And I'm thinking especially of the burn. So this is our best impression we can get of what the first early woodlands in Ireland were, with this hazel dominating.
Michael went on to explain how, over thousands of years, more and more trees appeared, how pine, oak, elm and ash all became established, growing together to become the rich deciduous woodland that then carpeted most of the island. Woodlands that might have been similar to the woodland I'm standing in now with Michael, except with wolves and bears and a whole lot more wildlife around. But what about humans? Who were the first people to arrive on the scene? And how did they live and interact with wild nature?
In all probability, they were people that we refer to as the Mesolithic people. In other words, they were hunters and gatherers living by the seat of their pants. What they favoured were rivers, coastlines, where there was a lot of food to be had in the sense of shellfish. They collected hazelnut, was really important for them. They would have found maybe there were a lot of birds, and they did kill and eat birds. But large mammals, we were pretty poor in these. In Ireland, as far as we know, there were very few red deer, and we even suspect that possibly red deer were brought here by the first farmers, that they weren't here naturally themselves. One of the big mammals that they brought with them was the wild boar. Of course, the wild boar are pretty happy in woodlands. Acorns, that's one of their favourite foods. So the wild boar would have been a good source of food.
Early settlers here would have lived in a world of trees, where birch, hazel, pine, oak and elm were growing as masters of the land. People travelled about in small groups, foraging and hunting, living in commune with nature for thousands of years. The impact of these Mesolithic hunter-gatherers on the landscape was pretty small. But then, about 6,000 years ago, everything changed. The first farmers, Neolithic people, arrived to these shores, bringing with them revolutionary new ways of living. And those that had lived by the old ways embraced the new ways of doing things.
What happened was farming arrived in Ireland. People and cattle and their cereals, etc., came to Ireland, were brought on boats. One of the things that I would be needing was for my cattle, possibly goats that I brought with it, I'd want space for those. I'd want to make sure that they had something to eat. They could nibble and browse, as we would say, in the woodland. But it would be nice to have a little bit of opening with more grasses, more herbs for them. And then for my barley and wheat were the main crops brought. And I would need space without trees to sow these in. And think of the difficulty this forested landscape must have presented. You had to cut down the trees, and what had you? You had only stone tools to do it.
So after about 5,000 years of Mesolithic hunter-gatherers, the Neolithic way of life brought the next big leap in how our ancestors lived. With new technologies, people became food producers rather than hunter-gatherers. And of course the landscape changed in response. Gradually, grasslands came to replace the woodlands that had dominated for thousands of years.
The Neolithic people, they were pretty different because they were farmers, and farmers need open space, especially for their cereals. So they had to clear woodland, which the Mesolithic people didn't have to do. And so we were getting an open landscape for the first time.
New technologies that arrived later with the Bronze Age brought the ability to cut more trees, graze more livestock, and grow more crops. Scientists like Michael have uncovered, for example, how over the space of a few thousand years, the wooded cloak that had come to engulf most of Ireland gave way to a patchwork blanket of open grassy pasture, wild woodlands, peat bogs, and areas where crops were grown. By the time Christianity arrived in Ireland in the 5th century AD, the landscape was already very different to what it would have been during the Bronze Age. There's a pattern emerging here. Each new influx of people, new cultures and new approaches, wrought enormous changes on the character of the landscape. One distinctive Irish mammal whose power permeates our ancient folklore is the wolf. Its demise tells the story of another wave of change that swept across Ireland's wild landscapes.
In the old Irish traditions, the entrance into the underworld was through the ground. So if you had a wolf denning in a cave, they seemed to be able to move between the other world and the world we live in.
I went to County Cork to speak with Dr. Ciarán Hickey from University College Cork, who explained the history of wolves in Ireland. Wolves were so common that they were specifically discussed in our first set of laws, the Brehon Laws.
The Brehon Laws, obviously, from the first millennium AD, prescribe how you would behave with a wolf, treatments of wolves in the area, keeping a wolf as a pet, what happens if you're a shepherd and you spot wolves and you don't inform your neighbours, and appropriate fines and punishments if you didn't behave according to the Brehon Laws. So they were common enough for that people actually had kind of regulations to deal with them.
Our ancient Irish ancestors seemed to have a great respect for wolves. They symbolised strength and connection with the powers of nature. Chieftains wore wolf skins in traditional ceremonies. But then new settlers here brought with them a different attitude to wolves.
When the Cromwellians came in, it was a very different approach because they were coming from a landscape where wolves had been gone for several hundred years, and they saw them as a direct threat to the colonisation of Ireland, the creation of, as I would describe it, as the shiring of Ireland, and to create a kind of shire-type environment where you had nice walled estates, you had peasant farmers, and you had a complete domination of the landscape, and you eliminated all the vermin.
The Cromwellian troops and settlers were resolute in their campaign to clear Ireland of its remaining wild woodlands, wild natives, and wild wolves. They implemented a well-planned and methodical extermination of wild Irish wolves.
Well, they went about it fairly systematically, as the Cromwellian government was quite good at. So they started with a series of bounties. The bounties were very substantial. It was £6 for a female, £5 for a male, £3 for hunting juveniles, and 10 shillings per cub. It's hard to get an obvious correlation with what we talk about today in terms of money values, but we're talking to thousands or tens of thousands. So there was a substantial amounts of bounties to be paid.
The efforts of the planters weren't just impacting the population of wolves. With woodlands up and down the land being felled, all manner of woodland wildlife would have suffered, and the landscape was transformed.
One of the aspects, of course, of the demise of the wolf is that the landscape of Ireland changed very dramatically from 1600 onwards. Native woodland probably went from 12 to 15%, probably down to 2% from 1600 to 1700. Because, of course, the oak woodland would have been an incredibly valuable resource. And at the time in Britain as well, there was a huge shortage of oak woodland, because oak was very important for construction, but particularly for the Royal Navy, because big pieces of oak were worth a fortune. Also, Irish oak was used extensively in the reconstruction of London after the Great Fire as well in the mid-1600s. So the planters, if they got a big tract of woodland, even though it would have been very wild and quite dangerous, in their minds, was still an incredibly valuable resource to be given at the time. They deliberately burnt the woodland to clear it of wolves and woodcairn, which are Irish rebels, and to clear all the denizens of the woods they didn't want as well. So it was strategically cleared, but also primarily economically cleared. So the landscape changed. Then you had the creation of these large walled estates, which we still have today, the creation of lots of farmland, the enclosure of field areas. So the landscape would have changed quite dramatically from being, in many parts, being wild to semi-wild, to being much more contained. And as the populations grew, the pressure on land increased and the amount of forestry decreased to the point where in 1900, Ireland probably only had 1% forestry cover. So the kind of landscape and ecology that wolves would have needed to survive was pretty much gone by the late 1700s, early 1800s, or was certainly going very fast. And once you're down to an unsustainable population, the technical term would be a ghost population, where the surviving population of a particular species are not sufficient to maintain the species long term, and they're effectively living ghosts. Somewhere between 1770 and probably 1790, my best guess is the last wolf was probably killed in 1786 on Mount Leinster.
Exterminating the wolf wasn't just about the end of one animal. It came about through an act of dominance, a politically motivated taming of wild Ireland. And after hearing about the speed and severity of the clearances from Ciarán, I'm left wondering if this marked a turning point in our relationship with the land. Cromwellian taming of wild Ireland made way for today's mosaic of farmed fields and hedges. We now live in highly modified cultural landscapes, although natural ecosystems rich in wildlife remained until relatively recently. But today, we are in the throes of another technological transformation, as land use becomes increasingly industrialised. We are losing bees, butterflies, birds, and whole ecosystems at a rate never seen before. Even agriculture is undergoing drastic changes.
Back in 1950s Ireland, an average farm was pretty small.
This is Pádraig Fógarty, an ecologist with an in-depth knowledge of nature in Ireland and author of the book Whittled Away, Ireland's Vanishing Nature.
It probably had some crops it was growing. It would have maybe rotated those crops. It would have grown maybe corn one year and oats another year. It would have grown potatoes and turnips. It probably had a few pigs. It probably had chickens. It might have had a donkey. It might have had a few cattle knocking around. Maybe there would have been one dairy cow. That's the model of farming as it used to be. And it was very small scale. It would have had used no artificial sprays or anything like that. But since the 60s, farming in Ireland, I suppose pretty much like everywhere else in the world, has been caught up in a global commodification market that really doesn't value that very small-scale diversity. Big supermarkets, big co-ops, big supply chains, they like one or two supply lines and they like it all to be the same. So farmers have been kind of sucked into that system, and it's been promoted by subsidies and grants and all these other things in the belief that we have to compete at a global level for all of these things. So nowadays, that farm that I described with its small-scale diversity is gone.
Fields that were filled with diversity just 20 years ago have become monocultures of shiny ryegrass. Today's intensive dairy farms are a world apart from the farming that was the norm until relatively recently. Thankfully, though, there are pockets of the countryside where farming and nature still work in harmony, where nature still thrives.
So we're just coming into one of the silage fields here.
This is Gerard Walsh, who owns a farm in Connemara with 80 acres of rough mountain pasture, bogland, hazel woodlands, and species-rich hay meadows.
Now, just to look at some of the species that exist in the kind of farm, the kind of grassland habitats. I suppose the main one that they talk about in is yellow rattle or hay rattle. There's a lot of it here in these fields, in these hay fields. I don't know if you can see. It's gone to seed now, and that's what you want in silage cutting, is to kind of cut the silage as late as possible. To allow the kind of wildflowers go to seed.
Gerard grew up in Dublin, but his family have been farming here for at least 200 years.
My family started out here. I know from family records, the Walsh name, they can trace it back to 1812 in the town on the Ballyquirk. Like all of rural Ireland, most of the population were small farmers up until, you know, a generation or two ago. I was born in Dublin, but spent a lot of summer holidays down here with my grandfather. And my father moved away from this place because probably these small west of Ireland farms were very hard living. So my father moved away and joined the police in Dublin. So I was born in Dublin, but always had a love of nature, a love of the environment.
As Gerard brings us around his farm, it's clear that he has a deep-rooted connection with the land here. He makes an effort to allow for all the species that live on his farm to flourish. And it's a wonder to witness.
And we're walking along a little laneway here. It's part of the farm. The cattle have access to this. You know, you can see all the kind of sorrel and pignut as we're looking. There's some John's wort there on the side there now, and the hawk bits, the different flowers that grow along naturally, the knapweed, all these kind of thistle there. Self-heal, all the different flowers that kind of grow naturally along a little boring like this. Good girls, come on, come on, come on.
Gerard's farm, like many small holdings all over Ireland, is what we generally call marginal farming. It's farming on the fringes.
Good girls.
There's a limit to the amount one can produce from marginal farmland, so returns are low. But these tend to be the farms that are rich in cultural heritage, where the low level of grazing sustains a diversity of wildlife.
I'm just looking at a butterfly flying there. We're passing a patch of hazel woodland here, hazel and ash woodland, so the speckled wood butterflies are active there. I just said hazelnuts are coming out currently. This would be an area, I suppose, of about a hectare of woodland. It's in my family, it's known as Sean's Wood. Now it's a hazel and oak woodland. If one was considered a productive farmer, one would probably come in and cut down this hazel and ash woodland. It's dry land, it's over limestone, and there's good drainage on it, so it could be made into quite a productive field. But I like, when there's a habitat there, I like to kind of keep it and preserve it.
Gerard is a true custodian of the land, something that's getting harder and harder to find in Ireland today. Listening to him talk about all that he sees as he walks the land, there's a richness in that. But farms like this are diminishing. They're not making a living. And there's a loss of the social fabric of rural Ireland, as these farmers can't continue anymore.
Nobody's making money in beef farming in Ireland currently. But that's the model that's presented by the advisory groups to how to farm that land. You're diminishing nature, and, you know, the butterflies and things we've seen today disappear.
As this kind of high nature value farming diminishes, so too do many of the plants and animals that marginal farmland like this sustain.
In this area, when I was a child, lapwing bred. I would have remembered the characteristic call of what my father would have called the Philippine, is the Irish name for lapwing. They're like curlew, one of the species, wading bird species, which is in decline in Ireland.
Lapwing is a bird that once nested all over Ireland. And in only 40 years, it has been brought to the verge of extinction here. farmers like Gerard's are battling against the waves of change sweeping over agriculture everywhere.
I do believe, yeah, that we're part of nature, and a lot of it is understanding the what the impact we have on nature. We have, through the use of chemicals and mechanised machinery, been able to change the landscape and change the nature of our relationship with the landscape very fast in the last 50 years. Up to that point, even with the arrival of, you know, from the Industrial Revolution, obviously farm machinery, and allowed areas which previously could not be cultivated to come into cultivation through drainage, through land clearance. So I think we have to bring consciousness to that process and bring an understanding of what impact we have.
Over the past 40 years, farming in Ireland has become a lot more intensive, more mechanised, more dependent on chemical fertilisers and imported animal feed. Industrial farming is pushing productivity to the limits, and the connection to the land is wearing thin. Farmers are often portrayed as the enemy of nature. But as we face a future of enormous challenges, farmers, as custodians of the land, might just be our saviours yet.
The one thing that's required for marginal farming to continue is love. Love of land, love of farm animals, love of cultural history of doing what people did in the past in these places. If the love doesn't there, the money and the financial rewards out of it are negligible. So that won't, they won't continue to happen. See the mountain ash berries, the orange berries standing out on the hillside. So the autumn is coming in fast. The year turns so quickly, you know.
I spoke to Pádraig Fógarty, who echoes these sentiments and talks about farms like Gerard's as part of a much bigger picture of the changes that are happening right before our eyes.
The people who've lived on the land for generations have been sucked into the same monster of a machine that the bees and the curlews have been sucked into, and they're being churned up and spat out the other end. And unfortunately, the relationship between people and nature has kind of broken down to somewhat. But if we're going to talk about the future, we have to start rebuilding that relationship.
Farmers are always out and about on the land. But what about the rest of us who don't own land or farm? We go to the coast or up into the hills and mountains to connect with nature. I donned my hiking boots and set off into the mists of the Wicklow Mountains with Helen Lawless, conservation officer with Mountaineering Ireland. I wanted to find out from Helen what it is about these mountain environments that draws so many hikers, and what this experience of wildness means to people.
People are attracted to Ireland's mountains for recreation because of the sense of space, because it provides an antidote to the structure and busyness in the rest of our lives. It's just wonderful to get out into an open space, to feel the wind on your face or the rain on your face, to walk by a mountain stream or river, to hear the bird song in the background, to enjoy the sights and smells of the landscape. We're, I suppose, inspired to explore the mountains for relaxation, also for challenge, and you know, we enjoyed the challenge of more of steep climbs and more technical terrain as much as we enjoy the feeling of sitting on a mountain summit, enjoying your lunch in the sunshine and naming distant peaks on a clear day. We've certainly got lots of deer present in this environment. Wicklow, I think, has almost half of Ireland's entire population of deer. Other animals that we have here in this landscape, certainly hares bounding along at speed across the hillside, a wonderful sight. We saw a skylark just a few moments ago, and there is that joy in the springtime of the male skylark singing his heart out to attract a mate. And the skylark is sometimes confused with the meadow pipit, which is our commonest mountain bird species. The meadow pipit flits about and has a beautiful sort of tseet sound that is almost the backdrop to the hills here. We have birds of prey as well. The Wicklow Mountains probably have a stronger population of merlin than many other mountain areas, but the merlin is a particularly secretive bird and difficult to see. The peregrine, one of our really iconic bird of prey species. There probably was woodland here, a lot of it up to the 13th century at least, and in the period following that, a lot of the woodland would have been removed. We had lost most of our woodland, I think, by the 17th century.
In Ireland, you never have to go far to walk through a patch of woodland or skim stones on a lakeshore. But true wilderness is something different. Do we have any real wild places left in Ireland? We think of our heather-clad hills as wild. They are certainly places where people can go to get away from it all, where we can feel the wind and see the open sky. Majestic raptors, such as hen harriers and merlin, also evoke a sense of wilderness in our hills. But are the mountains really that wild?
The primary land use, I suppose, across this landscape would be grazing, predominantly sheep grazing. There is a certain lack of diversity, I suppose, which is could perhaps be attributed to historic burning of this landscape. There has been a tradition of burning across the Wicklow Mountains to stimulate the growth of grass for sheep going out on the hills in the springtime.
Just because we can't see telegraph poles or houses, it doesn't mean that these remote places are really wild. Ireland's mountains are heavily modified by man's activities. Just a century or two of grazing, burning and turf cutting have utterly changed the plant and animal life here. So even out here, in the mountains we like to think of as wild, it's humans, not nature, shaping the lay of the land. And change is a constant.
Well, I think change is probably the only thing that we can be certain of. We tend to just, I suppose, look at the landscape in terms of the experience we've had of it in however long we have lived. But when we read or look back, we recognise that this landscape is in a state of constant evolution.
I have always loved studying the history of Ireland's wild nature and investigating how it continues to change today. I'm always intrigued at how so many places we think of as wild and unchanging actually looked completely different just a few generations ago. One of the things I find alarming, though, is how the pace of change we are seeing today is causing so many species to disappear.
Nature, I think, is in a bad place today. I think really wild nature certainly is gone. Maybe it's gone for an awful long time.
Porrig Fogarty gave me some more insights into just how drastically we've changed our landscapes in the last few decades.
Particularly in the last 100 years, and even particularly again in the last 20, 30 years, that has all changed radically. We've completely transformed all our ecosystems because so many plants and animals are, if they haven't already gone extinct, they're literally hanging on in tiny little corners here and there.
Salmon have gone from so many of our rivers. For Familiar farmland birds are nearing extinction. Native natural woodlands are now confined to tiny pockets here and there. The landscape has always been in a state of flux, but we are facing an unprecedented challenge now. We're losing our connection to nature, and we're losing so much in that process.
It's not just corncrakes, it's not just birds, it's not just farmland animals. It's sharks at sea. Sharks are one of the most endangered groups of animals we have in Ireland today. Nearly 60% of them are either threatened with extinction or near threatened. It's bees, it's butterflies, it's dragonflies, it's plants, it's mosses. It's every single group of plants and animals that we look at. And that's the message, that it's not just something bad happening in a corner over here or as a result of one particular type of activity. It's blanket across the land and the sea.
Nature has a habit of slipping away very quietly without us really understanding it or realising it.
This is Ella McSweeney, a journalist and broadcaster specialising in nature, food and farming in Ireland.
And it can be so gradual that it's imperceptible. And you look to older people who would say casually things like, for example, I remember meeting an older lady who said to me, "The sky up above used to be black with birds. Where have they gone?"
So many incredible species and habitats are disappearing from the skies above us, in the oceans around us, and even in the beloved green fields that surround us.
Even if you take the notion of our green fields, you know, we have this very popular image of Irishness being represented in this one verdant colour of green. And it even became sort of entwined and is entwined in our own identity. I mean, cultural nationalists used it as a way to identify Irish people both at home and abroad in the 19th and 20th century. And this notion of small green fields, particularly in the west of Ireland, as being a sort of a symbol of Irishness. And we associate that colour very much with the natural way of things, the wild Ireland, a notion of kind of purity and naturalness. And yet, when I think of this colour now, and we look around the fields of Ireland and their monoculture ryegrass, this glossy green is, I think, distinctly unnatural. It's because of the application of chemical nitrogen on the land, nitrogen fertiliser on the land. And I think it's an interesting thing to think about, because the idea of what we imagine to be wild and natural in Ireland is the very thing that actually isn't. It is the very definition of unnatural.
Because most of us are so disconnected from nature, we're fairly oblivious to what's happening. We seem to be struggling to comprehend the scale of the challenge ahead.
There's no doubt that the path we're on is one of destruction, and we live to a certain extent in an island that is full of ghosts, of missing species, the species that should be here that aren't here.
In more recent times, we've seen pretty much the industrialization of the natural world, whether this has meant catching fish from one time where it was done in rowboats with small nets to enormous factory ships that have nets literally the size of Croke Park. And of course, industrialization of our forests. What passes for forests these days would be a million miles from what a forest ecosystem actually is. It's monocultures of non-native species. And it even stretches as far as our rivers. I mean, we've straightened and deepened our rivers. They don't flow the way they used to flow. We've put barriers all over them. Most of our rivers are polluted now. So everything has just like a shadow of what it was in the past.
What can we do to reverse the devastating patterns of loss that are unfolding around us? Well, one approach is rewilding. Rewilding is about us rescinding control of nature, allowing nature to do its thing, instead of domesticating every element of the natural world. Rewilding is about leaving woodland trees to reseed themselves, letting rivers resume their natural course, giving nature space to recover. And for this to work, it has to be on a scale that's far bigger than our back gardens.
For rewilding to be, I suppose, what you might call real rewilding, or, you know, true to the original sense of the word rewilding, it has to be on a big scale. Because natural processes happen on a big scale, you can't really have a small, functioning native woodland. Woodlands operate over enormous areas and all kinds of interconnections with the soil. A lot of the larger animals that we would like to see come back need big areas in order to roam around. Now, it doesn't mean these areas have to be devoid of people, but the ecosystem, what we want is for that to operate on a large scale. So if I were to start somewhere, I would be looking at the mined out bogs, particularly along the River Shannon. We know it's the biggest no-brainer of an idea in terms of reducing our greenhouse gas emissions is to re-wet those bogs and get vegetation on them again.
Healthy peat bogs store huge amounts of fossil carbon, which has been locked away for millennia. But when bogs are drained and the peat moss extracted, enormous quantities of greenhouse gases are released. Most of our bogs in Ireland have already been industrially exploited, so their stores of carbon have escaped into the atmosphere. Peatland restoration can reverse this process by blocking up the drains and re-wetting these bogs.
So there's an enormous double whammy effect here to rewild bogs, lock up all that carbon and bring back a mosaic of woodlands and wetlands to the midland areas.
This is what people are calling rewilding. It's ecological restoration on a grand scale. I asked Porrig how rewilding could work in the Wicklow Mountains, where we were out walking.
We know somewhere like this used to be woodland. It used to be native Irish woodland, probably with a lot of birch trees, maybe with mountain ash and a variety of other species. And even though the landscape has changed a lot since then, the trees can still grow. We see trees growing here. There aren't very many of them, but little pokey holes here and there, there are trees trying to grow. I'd love to see that native Irish woodland return on an enormous scale. I mean, think about it. It could be this absolutely fantastic woodland stretching from the doorstep of Dublin right down into County Wexford. It would be absolutely amazing amenity for people. And of course, it would also help us suck up an awful lot of carbon. It would turn a landscape like this from a carbon source into a carbon sink. But for me, it would bring an element of wild nature back to the country, and that's something I think we can't put a price on.
The benefits of rewilding for our human societies are significant, from locking up carbon to holding back floodwaters, to allowing us to reconnect with wild nature. Large-scale rewilding projects are underway across Europe that will in time allow vast expanses of native woodlands and other missing habitats to return to places like the Scottish Highlands.
Going out into the Scottish Highlands, I saw the last few remnants of the Caledonian forest, the native pine woods of the Highlands, consisting only of old trees, dying of old age, and no new life taking their place.
I spoke with Alan Watson Featherstone, who has been involved in real rewilding projects since the 1980s.
In 1986, I organised a big week-long conference here at Findhorn about the environment, One Earth, A Call to Action. And it was all about the fact that we know what the problems are, we know what the solutions are, what's missing is the will to act, the commitment to do something about it. So I stood up in front of 300 people and said, I'm going to launch a project to restore the Caledonian forest. And at the time, I had no experience, no skills, no training, but I had this passion and I had this deep connection of the land and feeling I need to respond somehow. So that's how it began.
Alan's work to restore the Caledonian forests has inspired rewilding projects across the globe. But rewilding is a slow process.
The trees are slow to grow here. We have a harsh climate, it's windy, it's wet, the soils are depleted, most of the nutrients have been leached out because of deforestation in a rainy climate. So it takes a while to notice the difference. But it is profound when it happens. The first and most important thing that happens is the process of ecological succession starts to take place again. When we reduce the grazing pressure or we put up a fence to exclude the herbivores, heather begins to grow instead of the grass everywhere. And then through the heather we get the pioneer species appearing of trees. Those are things like birch, rowan, willow, aspen and so forth. They bring up nutrients from the soil through their roots, and they're all deciduous, and they deposit leaves on the surface of the ground every autumn, and those nutrients then become available for other organisms. And when the insects are there, the birds that eat them appear, the insectivorous birds come. And those birds often eat seeds as well, and the seeds germinate in their droppings, and you begin to get this reweaving of the web of life. The strands that we've severed in the past begin to re-establish. So the whole fabric of the ecosystem begins to recover.
The restoration of a great Caledonian forest is an ongoing project, with sites being actively restored across vast tracts of the Scottish Highlands, and new areas being identified for inclusion all the time.
So trees have grown, insects have come back, birds have recovered. We've now got beavers re-established in Scotland. Wild boar have escaped and now are part of the ecosystem. We've got birds of prey. We've got the sea eagle successfully returned. We've got red kites. Ospreys have come back by themselves. There's a lot of success stories showing what is possible when we choose to work with nature, and that we can pass on to our children a planet that is richer and more diverse than the depleted one that we've inherited from the past.
But what about here in Ireland? There are a few sites across the country where habitats are being restored. There are efforts afoot to reinstate raised bog habitats as required under European law. Wild Nefyn in North Mayo became Ireland's first official wilderness zone in 2013, with 4,000 hectares flagged for rewilding. But the authorities there have continued to plant commercial conifer trees within the site, throwing doubt over the wild credentials of the initiative. There are several privately owned estates across Ireland where the owners are taking it upon themselves to rewild their own landholdings.
Well, I think we have to find a balance between areas that are just for nature and areas that are for farming. At the moment, we have virtually nowhere in Ireland that is just for nature. So I think we should have areas that are just for nature, and we need to start with our national parks.
Once we begin to allow natural landscapes to recover their natural vegetation, many of the animals clinging on for survival will start to bounce back again. And that's when the interdependent elements of natural ecosystems can really come back into balance.
We could be bringing back cranes to the Shannon Midlands and bitterns. A bittern is a bit like a heron. It's a kind of a squat heron. We could also be bringing back a sturgeon. Sturgeon is a massive fish that used to live in our estuaries and inlets. Of course, the king of them all would be the wolf, wouldn't it? I mean, I think a lot of people would like to see the wolf coming back to Ireland. And I know it's a contentious idea. But for me, that idea of it being controversial almost is the point, because the wolf, more than any other animal, forces us to look wild nature in the eye. And for a lot of people, that's maybe a frightening or a disconcerting thing. But it's something we absolutely have to do if we're going to get out of the crisis that we're in.
Golden eagles have already been reintroduced to Ireland. There are other animals that could be brought back too. Restoring wild species and habitats is complex and deeply challenging in so many ways. But we do know that landscape-scale rewilding initiatives, such as those underway in Scotland, bring enormous benefits to all of us. Expanses of wild woodlands and rehabilitated boglands, these ecosystems sustain us in ways we are only beginning to understand. And the farmers like Gerard, with wonderfully rich hay meadows and pastures, they need to be supported and rewarded too, for farming in ways that work with nature. The benefits of high nature value farming are cultural as well as being necessary for sustaining wildlife on the brink.
It can be very alarming for people to hear ecologists in particular talk about rewilding as being separate from humans, being separate from communities, being separate from people, and using it almost as an excuse to displace and disrupt communities who've lived there for generations.
At the moment, we penalise farmers if they have trees and gorse and scrub on their land, but we could flip that relationship and incentivise landowners. So there is a place for landowners, absolutely.
There are critical choices ahead of us. But one thing we do know is that it's all hands on deck if we're to succeed in reversing the patterns of loss that are unfolding all around us.
The bottom line is, I think there's a growing constituency of people who really see the benefit of rewilding, particularly younger people who are concerned about the future. But then there are others who are still wedded to the what I view as an outdated concept, which is that the earth owes us a living from every square inch of its territory. And no matter how heavily exploited it is, we're going to exploit it more to make more profit. And that's what's destroying the planet, of course. And that, you know, has to change.
The COVID pandemic seems to have triggered a change in values. And people everywhere are finding solace in wild nature. From bringing back our wild bees to rewilding entire landscapes. These are mighty challenges. But the biggest change is the change that needs to happen within us. How we think of our place in nature.
You know, we all need to accept and recognise that there is a sense of urgency about what needs to happen. And it is each and every one of us, whatever your circumstance, whatever your own background, we can all find a way both to rewild our brains to a certain extent and find a way to re-entangle ourselves with nature, but also for people who are lucky enough to own tracts of land or be in a position of power when it comes to shaping policy, to make sure that we include in that an ecological mindset. And we must surely agree on the fact that a wild renaissance is needed, a sense that any decisions that are taken need to include the idea that we share this island with other species. We do not own this island. We aren't the dominant species. We must switch our thinking to the idea that we are here sharing with other species, and they have every right to live here in order to make sure that for future generations, the legacy we leave is not one of missing species and silence and no life, but one of abundance and noise and interest and fascination, and one where it is easy to fall in love with nature because there is so much nature around us.
A lot of what we hear about nature is about loss. And this leaves us anxious and disempowered. But a lot of what I'm hearing here is about love. Maybe love is the answer after all.
You have to love something in order to mind it and care for it and decide to sacrifice yourself for it. And I think rewilding asks of us to re-entangle ourselves with nature, spend time in nature. You fundamentally, it has to come from the beat of your heart, the kind of sense of falling in love with what nature has to offer.
The magic about rewilding is that it encapsulates this idea of reconnecting ourselves with nature. So it's not just about bringing wild nature back to a landscape, it's bringing ourselves back to wild nature and re-knitting these connections that we've lost. So to me, that's what rewilding is about.
me, my love, to the sea of love. I want it to. How much I love you.
The challenges we are facing are enormous. And unless we can collectively rekindle our love for the natural world, we probably don't have much chance of turning things around. I started out on this journey wanting to explore how Ireland's wild landscapes had changed through time and to figure out what the future might hold for nature on this island. I was looking for a clearer vision of how a wild renaissance might come about. And while I have a better overview of the opportunities and challenges involved in rewilding, I have discovered unexpected elements, like the role of love. What the future holds is of course unknown, but what I've come to understand more clearly is that we humans have been actively shaping the nature of Ireland for a long time. The choices we're making today determine the future for all of us. As long as we try to control and manage everything, we will remain on a path of destruction. When we approach the natural world with love and humility, it responds by providing us with all we could ever need. And that, I think, opens the opportunity, at least, for hope.
I love you.